Hey, it's Doug here. Just wanted to say hello before we send it to the interview with Karsten. That's Big Earn. And really fun interview. I met Karsten in Cincinnati, and it was funny. We kind of passed each other and nodded at each other. And then I said, hey, we haven't met before. And he started talking to me about asparagus. So that is an interesting thing that has happened in my life. Now I talk about asparagus all the time. I didn't really eat asparagus much up until a few years ago, and then I would have it every now and then. Now I have it all the time because it's just like top of mind. And this episode is brought to you by the Asparagus Growers of America. So it's a new sponsor popping in. I'm just kidding, of course. That's a joke. I don't think they want to be associated with us. But I mean, I think a lot of people are eating more asparagus out there these days. Quick note, I have been putting together and creating some more merchandise. People say merch, but it's just stuff that you could buy with our logos. And I created a few things out there. New t-shirts have asparagus on it because inevitably, like, that is what people talk to me about. So we have some asparagus shirts. Some of them still have the classic airplane logo with the mountains in the back. Sometimes they're on the back. I have some athletic stuff. So this is like a plain cotton t-shirt that I'm wearing right now. But I have like some pretty cool, like very soft hoodies that are out there too. But a lot of people, you're athletic, you do active stuff, and you want wicking shirts. So that's a few of the items that are out there too. So it might have the classic logo, may have some asparagus with mountains, another classic pairing that people see. So you can check it out. We'll put a link over there. Or if you're just thinking, hey, I want to go to milehighfi.com/store, it will redirect you over to the Etsy store. This is print on demand stuff. And you have to pay for shipping, and it's not like Amazon and all that stuff. So you could check it out. It helps support the show. Additionally, a couple things that you can check out. We have some links over to Amazon, and it will have a list of items that I personally use. So there's outdoor gear, there's some guitar stuff. I put the strings that I use, the picks that I use, all that kind of stuff. And you could check it out. All this stuff helps support the show. As a side note, everyone knows, well, if you listen to the show for a little while, you've heard me complain about being a hot sleeper and all that stuff. So it's actually starting to get really warm here in Colorado. And this is a little behind the curtain information. I'm recording this in the middle of June. So this episode is not actually coming out for like 2 months. Now, while I say I'm lazy all the time, I can work ahead so that I can have time off later. And in fact, I have to put people around me that are better at things that I am not that good at. So for example, producer Chris makes the show happen and he says, Doug, I need these shows. You're not done with this. You're not done with that. And come on, buddy, can you please finish your work? So I'll start working on it. And by the way, the show would not happen without Chris. Highly recommend you check out his blog, his epic financial journey. I think that's it. He'll put a link in the description here and make sure you get to it. So check out his blog. He and his friend work on it. But anyway, I get hot all the time. It's about to be 100 degrees here in the Longmont area. It cools off at night. And that's nice. And you wake up in the morning, it's crisp. You see the beautiful mountains and all that. But during the day, it's very warm. The sun is hot. And I get warm. I get warm. I have very sensitive skin. We're going up to the mountains. It's going to be amazing. We're going up to like 9,000 feet. It should be much cooler there. It's a town called Victor. We haven't been there before. We're going to check it out, stay for a few days. But it was one of those like last minute things. I'm like, hey, do you want to go to the mountains? And we like looked at a few different places. We looked at Leadville, one of my favorites, looked at Breckenridge, looked at Frisco. And there's not as many choices when you are waiting to the last minute. Plus we have Georgie, the dog. So that cuts down choices, makes it a little easier because you don't have to look through a million things, but you don't have as many choices. And basically we're going to Victor. And we haven't checked it out before. Apparently, it's near a town called Cripple Creek, which is near Colorado Springs. But it's very high in the mountains, and it should be quite nice and much, much cooler by like 20-some-odd degrees. Maybe more, like 25 degrees, probably. So anyway, we're heading up to the mountains. It'll be nice and peaceful and quiet. It's a very small town. I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to bring one of my guitars. It's kind of the beater guitar. It's the one that I got initially in college. So this guitar is like 25 years old. I think I got it in 1999 from a guitar center in Gwinnett County, Georgia. I think it was on Pleasant Hill. So if there's a handful of people that live in the Atlanta area, you might know where I'm talking about. It's up 85. And I got that guitar, and it only, you know, back then it cost like $200 or $300. I think it was like $300. And I beat it up. I brought it all across the country, all over the place. It's scratched up. It's well worn in. But the thing is, it was like rather inexpensive and it sounds great. I've done a couple minor upgrades, but like it sounds great. And the cool thing is, it's a beater guitar. I don't have to worry about it too much. So I mentioned sometimes that I have nice guitars and I enjoy them. At the same time, I don't want to worry like, hey, I'm going to leave this in the car while we go get gas. Is some person going to walk by and think, hey, I'm going to break into that car? With an old crappy guitar like this, they're not going to think, hey, I'm going to break into. And I don't know why I think that. There's not thieves looking for instruments of high value or whatever. But I'm from the city. I don't know. I think everybody's going to take everything all the time. When I went out there, when I went out to, what was it? We went on a bike ride a few weeks ago with a big group of people. And I may have mentioned this before, but basically I have a new e-bike and I have a lock. So I like locked it up, but other people were like, why are you locking up? That's silly. They didn't say it to me directly, but I heard later that people were making fun of me. It wasn't personal. I'm supposed to lock up my bike. You know, I'm doing what I can, but like I said, I think everybody's going to steal everything all the time. So anyway, we're heading up to the mountains. I'm going to bring the old guitar. I've been practicing my flat picking, like bluegrass stuff here recently. And another note that I have, I have some post-it notes of things that I've been up to, but I have actually been playing music with a friend in town named Eric. So if people have passed through Longmont, perhaps you met Eric. And yeah, we played a little bit like last week, and then I've been playing with my friend Tyler. And if you're in the Colorado area, he's putting together some coffee meetups in the Highlands Ranch area. That's sort of the southern Colorado, not southern Colorado, but it's this South Denver area rather. So he's putting together some stuff there. He plays drums. I make some noise on the guitar. It's very fun. And recently, we did like an open jam at the Mr. Money Mustache HQ area. Just a few folks showed up when I went. There were only about four. Pete was there. Kristen and Carla were there. So I played guitar. Kristen was on the ook. And Pete played bass. I think it was a five string. I feel like there were five strings on that bass. And then Carla was on the keys over there. So it was nice. We didn't have a drummer. We missed Tyler that specific day through scheduling issues and whatnot. But anyway, I've been playing music and it's awesome. I have such a good time. And I could tell by playing with other people, I've gotten a little bit better. And just having the guitar in my hands more often and for more hours, it really makes a difference. And it's such a fun activity. I feel like it's developing my brain and coordination. And I could tell that I'm getting better. It is such a slow process though. And I think I've heard, well, a lot of people say like, I don't have any musical talent. I don't pick it up or whatever. I don't pick it up either. It's just through sheer repetition over and over and like playing that one measure again and then going slower and then doing it slower and then finally not making a mistake and then you can slowly speed up. It potentially drives people crazy in the house here since it's just repetition and over and it's literally, it might be eight notes over and over again, like 400 times and then you stop. You come back to it a little bit later, and then you do it again. This has been Story Time with Doug. It was really fun to record with Karsten. I'm going to see him. Many of us will see him in Portland for FinCon. So if you happen to be going to Portland, look out for Karsten. It's in his general vicinity, and I think I may have a beer with him. So thank you, Karsten, for recording with me. I'm looking forward to chatting with you soon, and enjoy the episode. Thank you. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm pumped to have Big Earn on the show. Karsten is your real name, is that right?
Correct, yep.
But you answer to either one if people see you, right?
Yeah, I've gotten used to the Big Earn moniker, and I've had this really only since I started blogging. So it's not like Big Earn was always my nickname when I was growing up, right? I mean, I was Karsten, yeah. KJ, Dr. J sometimes would call me, right? So a tall guy. It was a basketball player. Yeah, so people came up with pretty inventive stuff. But so the Big Earn stuff stuck because I like the nickname because I was anonymous initially. So I like that people gave me a nickname like that and ran with that.
So you're the founder of the blog Early Retirement Now. And the thing is, you're highly qualified, perhaps overqualified to even be on the show. You have a master's and PhD in economics and statistics, or economics just straight up.
Right. I never had a minor, but where I studied economics, it was very heavy on the math and statistics side. Yeah.
So very good. Okay. So today we're going to go into a couple different areas. One is one of my favorite books, Die with a Zero. And I think we'll have an interesting conversation because most of the time people are like, Die with Zero, it changed my life. I really like a lot of points in that book. And it actually did change our lives. Like, I got my wife to read it. And there were a couple pieces that she took away. And she was like, you know what? I need to make this a priority to retire. You have some counterpoints. And unfortunately, when I read your blog, it's number 60 in the Safe Withdrawal Rate series. It was like you told me there was no Santa Claus. I was like, oh man, Karsten, what are we doing here? So anyway, we'll get into some details around that, but we'll also talk about small cap value, which has been getting a little more, I guess, conversation in the FI community overall. And again, like you bring up some great points. And before the interview, I was like, I feel like I'm learning so much, but at the end, I don't know what to do. Like, I have more information, but it doesn't tell me what to do. So let's talk about Die with Zero. You're a great writer. So you start off the blog post, which we'll link up so people could check it out. But there are some points that you do enjoy from Die with Zero. Do you want to highlight one or two here?
Oh, yes. I mean, I like the general idea, right? Because in our FIRE community, right, we are the overaccumulators, overachievers. And we are not facing that other problem that a lot of Americans face, right? The overspending and not saving enough. And so could we have gone too far to the other side of the spectrum, right? It's good that somebody points this out. So I appreciate that. And I also, I like the idea that something that's, I would call it estate planning, right? So imagine you are the average couple, you have kids, and you have all of this big nest egg. Do you want to hold on to all of this until you die? And then your kids only enjoy some of the fruits of your labor and your investing when they might be in their 50s or 60s, which is kind of late. On the other hand, of course, you don't want to set up your kids as some kind of a trust fund baby, right, who has nothing in life to work for and is then complacent and lazy. So you want to thread the needle, right, and find something in between. And I like the idea that occasionally you should check your finances and ask yourself, well, have I overaccumulated so much that I can give away some of my net worth and then, for example, help my kid? And I mean, absolutely, we are planning to do that, right? I mean, I'm totally more than comfortable setting aside somewhere between $250,000 and $500,000. Don't tell my daughter this yet, but and give her that before she turns 30, right? And that comes as a package. I mean, part of this is, I mean, we're not minding any expenses right now. She's in fifth grade, so it's actually not very expensive to keep her happy. But at some point, right, we have to pay for her college, and we'll help her with that. So hopefully she'll be debt-free coming out of college. And then imagine the average college graduate, you start with zero, and then you live in an expensive city and you need a down payment for a house, right? So, and should you be on this eternal treadmill as a renter where you will never amount enough to accumulate a down payment for a house because the rent is too high and the housing market prices, they're running away, and they're running away faster than you can accumulate your down payments. This happens to a lot of young people these days. And maybe it just takes this one little push to get people over the edge, and then things start running on their own. And for example, when I bought my first house, that is, it was something like $270,000, and it was relatively easy to come up with that down payment, but not everybody has that luxury. So I absolutely agree with the general premise. Give some money away when you're still alive. There's a saying in German, you want to give money with warm hands as opposed to cold hands when you're dead. And I totally subscribe to that. I'm a big fan of that general philosophy. And it was good to read that book in that way. Is that I haven't really learned anything fascinating new, but you learn a new angle of something that you already felt intuitively that was the right thing to do.
How do you say that German phrase? My wife's studying German, so I'll actually like let her listen to it.
Man will Geld mit warm, gib mit warmen Händen. So give with warm hands, gib mit warmen Händen. That would be the phrase. And probably there's some regional variations of that. It's a small country, but the language and culture is also a big country. So it may not be the same phrase everywhere.
Got it. Okay. So, and I'll mention a couple things that I did like from Die With Zero, and then I'll ask a question, because you retired early, and I think it's worth going into just a little bit there. So biggest thing that I got from it was around time bucketing. And I think, you know, from getting to know you a little bit, like you maybe intuitively like had that mindset already. And it's not that I wasn't thinking about doing things sort of during the right decade or few year period where I'm able to do it, but I think a lot of people forget that. Quick example, and if people aren't familiar with this part of the book, essentially, I don't like bucket lists specifically, but you put together a list of stuff that you want to do, and you kind of put it into decade periods like 40s to 50s, 70s to 80s. So for example, right now I'm in my 40s, relatively healthy. I could travel. I could be on a plane for a long time. I could do more physically strenuous things. When I'm in my 80s, if I'm lucky and I make it to my 80s, maybe I want to do some cruises where it's a little more, you know, less active, just generally less active, things are taken care of. So that was a big thing where it like accelerated that, where, okay, if I want to go to some of these national parks and Alaska, where you have to take a little bush plane, I probably need to do that as soon as possible, because I'm not going to want to do it when I'm in my 70s, most likely. So that was a big thing for me. You retired early. Can you talk about that? I mean, you've been retired since like 2018 or so.
Right, right. And then again, yeah. So even before the estate planning, right, just for my own personal enjoyment. Yes, obviously. So that also impacted me, right? I want to do certain things when I'm still younger. And this is one of the main reasons why we retired early, right? So because we wanted to do very extensive traveling. So in 2018, we were on the road for 7 months, 2019, another 4 months. In between, we had bought a house and set that up. So we did this all before our daughter started kindergarten. And then I can also see that, I mean, you can take your kids out of school for a year and do some kind of world travel and do the education along the way. That was not really on our radar screen, but we had the same thing. We had the same philosophy, right? I mean, we are young now. We can do some of the travel plans that we always wanted to do. And then also some of the roughing stuff, right? Basically hauling suitcases from the Airbnb to the train station and hopping on a train and then going to the next Airbnb. So yeah, probably I'm not going to do that when I'm in my 70s and 80s, right? Then I want to do the river. We forget about cruises. Then I want to do the river cruises or something like that. Yeah. So something super exclusive. Because we are cruising a lot even right now. Yeah, it's exactly as you say, right? You have your health and the time in your 40s when you stop working. It's basically everything comes together, right? You have your health and your time and the money if you play it right. Because usually this is always, one is always missing, right? If you're young, you have no money, but you have a lot of health and time. And then when you're old, you have a lot of money and time, but no health. And then middle-aged, this is where you can probably square square the circle there. If you retire early, and I mean, you just look at your numbers, and if everything is enough already, why do you want to keep working, right? I mean, there's such a huge opportunity cost of keeping that, especially they're very, very stressful corporate job, as it was in my case, right? So you have only so many vacation days. Even if you go on the vacation, right, we would usually travel for only a week, maybe international trip, sometimes 2 weeks. So by the time you get used to the new time zone in Europe or in Asia, right, it's almost time to get packing again and fly back. And then you come back and you're a total zombie at the office for a few days from the jet lag on the flight back. So there's definitely, I like this idea of the bucketing of what you want to do at what stage in your life. And at that time, I didn't even know the book. I think the book wasn't even published back then. But intuitively, I had the same philosophy and intuition. Yes, absolutely. I like that part about the book too.
How did you, did you have examples in your life, maybe your parents or relatives that did something like that? Because I mean, you're accomplished, you had a great career. I mean, people could have some friction on that, right, with their family. And I'm curious if you had an example of this.
I grew up in a relatively modest family. So my parents, it's not that they were unintelligent, it's just they were just uneducated, not unintelligent. It's just growing up at that time in Germany, they were just not very good educational opportunities, right? So they were in their teens, right around 1945 when
post-war.
You didn't just go finish high school and then go to college and grad school so easily. I mean, some people did, but my parents and grandparents didn't have the means for that. So in some way, my generation, so my brother and I, we were the trailblazers as the first within our extended family to go to college. And I'm probably the first person to retire early in a self-made kind of way. I mean, I had some uncles that got some really good early retirement packages because they were working for Volkswagen at the time, and they were encouraged to retire already in their late 50s, which was amazing. Amazing early retirement for German standards at that time. But in terms of the, you know, very aggressive equity investing, retiring early, I'm probably the first in my family to pull that off. So.
Got it. There were some issues with Die with Zero. Like I said, it wasn't really apparent. Like when I read a book, I know I'm not going to agree with everything. And right. I'll take away the things that I like. And I pretty much forget the stuff that I don't agree with. And maybe that's not the greatest way to do it, but it's just, you know what? Like it works for me so far. So let's go over, we're not going to go over all the issues with the book, but there were a couple that were kind of big in my opinion, and I'll let you pick your favorite one. Perhaps we can just go from there. But yeah, what was sort of the most egregious problem that you saw?
So the most egregious is obviously, so I mean, obviously he has to come up with some kind of a formula. If he tells you, you have got to spend more, well, how much do I spend, right? So imagine here's somebody who has X million dollars, spends this much every year, and has maybe a life expectancy of this many more years. So he comes up with this very ad hoc formula where he says, well, you should have a net worth equal to your annual budget times the number of years, and then he gives it a what you could call a haircut or something. You multiply that by 0.7, right? Because you have a little bit of asset return that can help you. So you don't have to have exactly your budget times the number of years. Right? You should have some portfolio return along the way. So you just multiply that by 0.7. Looks like a very nice and easy formula, but I mean, it's obviously completely wrong because it would be far too high for very long horizons. So imagine you have a 60-year horizon. It would recommend you to have 42 times your annual spending in the bank, which, I mean, I'm more on the conservative side, but you don't need that much, right? Because you have, it's almost like an amortization exercise, right? So the number of the multiples you need as a function of the horizon isn't exactly linear. It basically dies off and it increases very slowly at the end. It's like if you check how much money can you take out or how much money do you have to pay for a 15-year mortgage versus 30-year mortgage, right? It's not exactly twice the payment for the 15-year mortgage. So there's some non-linear math in there. And of course, the math is not exactly linear and deterministic and certain. for withdrawals, but it has the same flavor. So there's a non-linearity. So he's becoming way too conservative on the very long end. And then on the very short end is also, so for example, if you have 10 more years and you have only 7 times in the bank, that might also be wrong. But on the other side, that might be too little money in the bank, especially if you have any kind of risky assets, right? If any of your 7X portfolio is in the stock market, it might be too volatile. If most of it is in safe assets, then your returns are not big enough to compensate for that shortfall. So my main concern was that, I mean, for somebody who apparently used to work in finance, and then he comes with such a lazy rule, I almost fell off my chair when I read that. And then the other thing is also as a philosophically where you say, you know, one of the reasons I think that people are not comfortable withdrawing money from their portfolio in retirement is that they don't fully trust the 4% rule, right? They say, well, is this really, there's going to be some uncertainty, right? What if future market returns are worse? What if my expenses are going to go up later in retirement? What if taxes go crazy? A lot of people say that, well, I don't really trust the 4% rule. And I think a lot of advisors, I think they're also lazy. I think the 4% rule is also not particularly useful. But now you're replacing a rule that is already not that useful with something that's even less useful and more ad hoc, because it doesn't, for example, take into account that you might scale down your spending later in retirement, right? You might have yourself an inheritance later, right? You might sell your house and move into a cheaper rental apartment later in life. So all sorts of stuff can happen that you could customize. We don't need more simplicity on that side. I think we need more customization. And he's going in the other direction. So using something that is already kind of generic and dumb, I sometimes call it the dumb rule of thumb, the 4% rule. And you're even dumbing it down even more. So that's why I'm not a huge fan of this approach. But sure. I mean, philosophically, it's fine. Some of the math in this book is really highly suspect. So
right. So yeah, that interesting one as well. And when he mentioned that amount, I was like, it seems like it's, you know, you're oversaving, like to your point, exactly. To turn it around, I'm curious if you could steel man why he may have dumbed down a simplified rule already. Do you have any theories on that?
I think this was basically just an afterthought. I mean, he definitely started with this whole philosophy, and he probably spent 99% of this on getting that part straight, and then basically tailoring the book in such a way that it becomes a bestseller, right? That it gets some talking points, that he gets invited to all the right podcasts and maybe even TV morning shows. But yeah, I mean, in the end, probably somebody asked him, well, yeah, if you tell people you should withdraw more money, well, how much should they withdraw? And well, doing it right would have been another 200-page book. And then he came up with basically this afterthought. Okay, I'll just come up with something quick to cover that base. I can only speculate, or maybe this was all written by some ghostwriter. So in fact, I kind of hit him a little bit on that. It almost sounds like he has this very overconfident and self-aggrandizing style. I could have thought that Tony Robbins wrote this. So if people are just fine with the philosophy, it's good. If it helps you in some way to pull the plug and retire, if it helps you spread the wealth and give something to your kids, and you give it with warm hands and not on your deathbed, more power to you. So I hope people get all the right information out of that book.
Very good. And I'll add, I was going to say, like, I think he could have put that in because he didn't want to just regurgitate the 4% rule. But he wanted to also have something pretty simple. And I understand, well, like, I mean,
he couldn't use the 4% rule because the 4% rule is for 30 years, right? You had to have something. Well, what do you do if you are now past regular retirement age and you are now 75 and maybe you have only 20-year horizon, you want to have something for these people too, or you want to have something for the ultra early retirees that retire in their 30s and 40s because they used to work in finance or in engineering, and they should pull the plug exactly for this time bucketing rationale. And so he needed to have something that is time dependent, not just the 4% rule. But hey, all it would have taken is, and I have these charts in my blog post where I say, well, this is the safe withdrawal rate if your horizon is, and then again, this is not even customized either, right? Because this doesn't depend on any of your idiosyncratic parameters like spending increases or decreases later in retirement, but just the generic case, flat spending. So these are the different basically anchor points, and then just do a table. If you have 5 years life expectancy, this is how much you should have as a multiple of your expenses. And for 10 years, 15 years, all the way to 60 years, I think that would have been already helpful and actually would have looked more scientific and credible than this very ad hoc rule. So, but again, it's his book. I'm happy he's successful.
And we're talking about it. It makes good conversation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. There is no bad publicity. So,
the biggest issue that you pointed out that hit me the worst was around the cherry picking of data. He makes a big deal about how much money people have like overaccumulated and not spent. He cites, I think it's a Federal Reserve was actually the
right. It's called Survey of Consumer Finances, and it's a highly, highly credible and serious source. So this is not just some survey that somebody did over the phone. This is some huge amount of time and effort and intellect spent to put these data together. Yeah. So,
and yeah, go ahead. What was the issue with this?
And so basically the issue is, it's basically cherry picking the data and where he says, well, look, here is one survey of consumer finances. And he points out that, oh, here is the bucket of 75-year-olds and here's the bucket of 65-year-olds. And the 75-year-olds have higher retirement savings than the 65-year-olds. I could look it up. What are the exact numbers there? I think the buckets were, you have the age of the reference person, one is 65 to 74, and then the other one is 75 plus. So he found this one survey, and by the way, this survey is done only every 3 years, right? It's actually a lot of data collection, a lot of survey, as you really follow some actual household over a certain number of years, and they submit all the bills, all the brokerage statements that they get. It takes some time to put this together. So, and I think he used the 2016 survey, and lo and behold, it looked like the 75-year-olds had more money than the 65 to 74-year-olds. And he makes this big brouhaha out of that. Oh, look at that. There is a cohort that grew their money from age 65 to 75. So that is wrong on multiple different levels. So first of all, it's wrong. So then that made me, as I'm this geek, and basically almost like a detective dog that, okay, once I smell blood like this, it was, oh, how come he looked at the 2016 survey? Because when he wrote the book, the 2019 survey was already out. And then I found, well, in the 2019 survey, it's actually the other way around. In the 2019 survey, the median net worth is actually a little bit lower for the older cohort. So why didn't he mention that? And then I went back, all the other cohorts before that is actually also quite correct that the older households have a little bit less assets. So it's basically cherry picking. Oh, and then by the way, after I wrote the blog post, also the 2022 survey came out. And there again, the same pattern repeats. It's actually the older households have a little bit lower assets than the fresh retirees. So he makes all of this, he tries to make a lot of hay out of this one observation, but it was really an outlier. And the other thing that was something that actually was, even if he had been correct, right, that there is, well, 2016, yeah, I mean, the older cohort has more money than the younger cohort, it does not mean that the older cohort kept accumulating, right? Because this is a general fallacy that people sometimes make, right? They look at a snapshot of the data, right? They look at a bunch of people that are today 65 and people that are today 75, And that if the 75 people today have more money than the 65-year-old people, it does not mean that today's 75-year-old people have more money than they had 10 years ago, right? So for me, the shocking insight was that, oh, so here's a guy who used to work in finance and should have some, I think he has an MBA in finance and he worked for a hedge fund or something. So here's somebody who should have some basic data analysis skills, and he falls for basically one of the oldest tricks in the world, basically mixing up cross-sectional data versus time series data. And I don't want to get into the really nitty-gritty stuff of data analysis and statistics, because we could speak just an hour on that. But I found that also a little bit lazy, that either he didn't know the difference or he knew the difference, but it was basically just some confirmation bias. He found a data point that made his point, and then he ran with it, even though he knew that this is from a statistical and data analysis right. point of view is highly suspect. It's actually, and then on top of that, right? I mean, even if the 75-year-olds grew their portfolio over the last 10 years, is it because, I mean, is it really true over accumulation, or is it, it could be just luck, right? It could be just that one cohort that over accumulated, but nobody knew how well the stock market is going to perform, right? Between say 2012 and 2022, these are some of the best 10-year windows ever in the history of the stock market. So 2009 to 2019, 2012 to 2022, you had absolutely spectacular return. So if you accumulated your assets a little bit, then you say, well, so what, right? I mean, people were just hedging and maybe building a little bit of extra assets, because at some point the market goes down again and we're going to have a bear market. We had a bear market in 2022, by the way. It's not really, I wouldn't call this a great retirement crisis of old households vastly over accumulating assets. I mean, it could be just an artifact of the more recent data, and it would have looked very different over some other horizons. So,
right. Yeah. And it's so interesting. I mean, you bring up, there's some nerds out there, other geeks just like you, Karsten, that were like, oh, let's go into the cross-sectional. I don't even know what term you said, right. Man. What was it? Cross-sectional data versus time?
So cross-section is where you have a snapshot of today's, right? You have young people, middle-aged people, old people. That would be a one-time observation, which is a cross-section. You can have a time series. You could follow some households over a certain time. And then you can also have panel data, right? Which would be, you are following a whole panel of different households. So you have some cross-sectional data and time series data, because you follow each household also over a certain number of years, or maybe potentially many years. And so basically what these Survey of Consumer Finances snapshots are, and what he pulled, these were just the one-time snapshots. Yeah. You have no idea that the people who are 75 years old, why they have much higher assets than the 65 years. It may just be they had the very lucky retirement timing, and so they maybe that's why they have slightly higher assets. Yeah. It's not their own over accumulation. It's a different effect than what the author there wants to bring up.
Yeah, and like I said, it's so interesting, because like I took away from the book what works for us, and I think like people in the FI community, we tend to oversave. Maybe we're a little too frugal. That's another great point in the book. Like sometimes, you know, if I could buy back some time and have some people do work for me, that's great. Yes. It helps the local community, right? Like if I hire landscapers or whatever, it's a win-win situation all the way around. So I took away what I needed. And I think for us in the FI community, it hit at the right time. After there were many years of blogging or bloggers that, you know, now they're saying, hey, you know what? I was maybe a little too aggressive with the saving. I should have opened up and learned how to spend a little bit more. So I took that away, even though like now that we're looking at this, I'm like, you know what? Like, I think Bill Perkins is pretty smart. He probably understood the points that he was making. And, you know, it's a good persuasive argument through the whole book. Before we move on to small cap value discussion, anything else you want to bring up around Die with Zero? You wrote a lot more about it as well, and we'll link up so people can check out your charts and other information, but any broad points?
And again, I think he is probably generally right? I mean, because a lot of retirees and even personal finance bloggers and retirees, we may need some training and psychological rewiring to start spending and spending aggressively and confidently. I think my wife and I are doing a pretty good job. So we splurge on certain things. I mean, we are no longer overly frugal. By the way, even some of the things where we are frugal, it's almost like a more of a sport, because you're just a generally competitive person, right? And you feel so good of buying, I don't know, the kitchen towel at Costco, and you realize, oh, this is 25% cheaper than this other brand. And I think you could still do that if it gives you some pleasure. I mean, we are not doing it because, we have to. But then we just totally blow money on other things like cruises and some other luxury items. I'm not going to get into the exact specifics. I don't want burglars to break into my house tonight. So it's so we like to spend. And by the way, we spend mostly on experiences anyways, not so much on material goods. But I think we're doing a pretty good job both at the spending side. And then once our daughter is a little bit older, I think we'll also be very generous with her, setting her up in a way that she has maybe a little bit of a head start, but doesn't feel like a trust fund.
Baby. Yeah. So. All right, I want to ask you a question, which we could edit it out, like, and punt it if you're like, hey, I don't want to answer. I didn't prepare you for this. You have no idea what I'm going to ask, do you?
Okay.
It's great. No, it's not too bad. So if I understand right, you still earn some money on the side and it covers some expenses. Right. So you're not withdrawing, but I'm curious, like, what your annual expenses are if it were to be a percentage of your portfolio. Like, what is that? Do you know that exact amount?
Yeah, so I think we're spending about, and it's actually shockingly low. It's probably somewhere around 3% of our portfolio only. And I think we could definitely go a little bit higher than that, especially considering that, you know, these are the years when we can really spend quite aggressively, say on travel and stuff like that. Once we are older, a lot of people with, say, I mean, not just the generous, but we call it fat fire in the fire community, right? So having a very generous retirement budget is pretty solidly into the six figures, by the way. So, and I'm also considering, so the withdrawals, they also include what I have to pay in estimated taxes. I actually owe quite a lot of money in estimated taxes for federal, because our income, our taxable income is still quite high. We spend 3%. We could probably still spend even a little bit more than that. So
got it. Well, and thank you for sharing that. I was going to say, like, we hired an advisor, and that enabled my wife to be confident in retiring. That was just about 18 months ago. And actually, like, I wrote it down in our little book. Our projected, this is way more conservative than I want it to be, by the way. All right. So I'm disappointed to share this. So our projected budget is roughly 3.75%, which is down in a range which you find respectable. Yeah. Which you know, before I knew you, I just wanted to disagree with you, you know, because I feel like you're pushing that 4% rule down. I'm like, I want to spend more, but you're a reasonable dude.
You back
it up with data. Our actual, so that's what's budgeted, 3.75. The actual from last year is 2.81%.
Oh, and I'm like,
you know, that's too low, man. It's too low. Even you're ahead. So
yeah, exactly.
Like I've been each year I'm talking to the advisor and my wife, and like, all right, hey, like, I think we're underspending. Like, we need to beef it up a little bit. And it's not that we want anything. We're doing all sorts of fun stuff, but it would be experiences, like visiting family more. And like, that's where we want to push like the extra that we're not spending. At some point, like, we'll open it up, but yeah, it's one of those things. Now, did you have a hard time, like, you're opening up spending in certain areas? Did you have a hard time adjusting, or was it, you're like, we feel confident in this?
Well, I mean, we had a long enough runway. Now, it was now retired almost to the day 7 years ago. So, I mean, it's definitely crept in over time. So, I mean, we have a house and we're almost looking for stuff to fix or update. We just did the bathrooms last year. I mean, they could have probably stayed a little bit longer. Kitchen would probably be the next one. And I mean, you will always find something. And then on top of that, right, so especially if you're a homeowner, you can, Of course, something really serious breaks, then you got to fix it. But so some of these updates, you can obviously time them in such a way that you do that if it's an opportune time, right? If the stock market is up, if the stock market is depressed, well, you just hold back on some of that cosmetic stuff at least. So we do the travel. We shop pretty confidently. So we're going to spend about 2 months this summer, much of it abroad, cruises, international trip. We're going to fly to the Philippines. We're going to do a cruise from New York City via Nova Scotia, Greenland to Iceland, and then spend some time in Iceland and fly back from there. For example, cruising, right? The cheapest cruise you can do on a per day basis is the Caribbean, right? Which is because there's a lot of competition and it's almost like a commodity, right? I mean, everybody offers the same kind of cruise out of Tampa or Miami. We have done only very few cruises like that. So most of our cruises are more, which I call exotic, not in the conventional sense, but exotic in the cruising sense, right? So we did a lot of cruising in Arctic climate, right? So we did Alaska, we did Norway, the Nordkap. We're going to do Greenland. We did the Norwegian fjords, so the southern tip of New Zealand. We're going to do out of Buenos Aires to Antarctica later this year in December. So we did the Suez Canal, we did the Panama Canal. We like cruising, but we like the cruising, the more unusual destinations. And that's usually a little bit more expensive too. So we definitely spend very aggressively and lavishly on that. So.
All right. I'll put a pin in that. I want to talk to you about that. We don't do much international travel now, but for cruising, like the places you mentioned, the colder climates, super interested in that. And then the Antarctic trip, I mean, that's going to be insane. Yeah. Okay. But we got to move on here. So small cap value, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about it more. And I was thinking to myself, and I in fact brought it up with the advisor, hey, should we add some small cap value? I've been hearing about Efficient Frontier. Like, it seems like the data is foolproof, right? When I hear people talk about it, but it's not that simple. So I did some reading on your blog and I learned a lot, but I don't think I have a clear answer. So can you just explain, I guess, the premise? Just to lay the foundation for people that aren't super familiar with adding, you know, a piece of small cap value in instead of just like VTSAX or some total stock market with some bond on the side.
Right. So small cap value has been a style in equity investing. And by the way, if you own the VTSAX or VTI, which is the ETF version, or any of the other overall market ETFs and mutual funds, you already own that piece, right? Because you own both large and small. And then on the value versus growth side, you also own all of the value and all of the growth stocks. So, and what some people pointed out is that if you look at historical returns going all the way to about 1926, there was a pretty amazing outperformance of one style, and that's small cap value stocks. And so somewhere between 1926 until about the 2000s, so something like 2005, 2006, you would have gotten an extra return that is absolutely spectacular. So depending on what exact index you use and how you put this together, because there were no ETFs and mutual funds going all the way back, but you can rely on some kind of made up simulated data, you could have garnered something like 3.5-4, maybe a little bit more than 4% extra return over and above what, say, a broad equity index would have fetched. And that definitely gets people's attention, right? And this is also not any kind of a fluke, right? This is, academics have written about this. There is sometimes it's falsely attributed that, oh, this even won a Nobel Prize. That's actually not true, because so the two researchers that brought this up are called Farmer and French. So Ken French and Eugene Farmer. And Eugene Farmer won the Nobel Prize, but for something else. So not for the Farmer-French style factor analysis. But people sometimes extend this a little bit and say, oh, this is actually a Nobel Prize winning insight. But I mean, it might as well be a Nobel Prize winning insight. Maybe somebody wins a Nobel Prize for it in the future. But it's definitely very intriguing that small cap and value stocks did very well. But then just like when everybody knows about this flavor and it becomes mainstream, then it fizzles. this is something that potentially might have happened here too, because since 2006, and it's actually worse than just fizzling, right? Because if you had made 4% extra per year for the first 80 years, say from 1926 to 2006, let's make it round numbers, and now you have another almost 20 years, 2006 until now, this is 19 years. So the last 19 years were actually very underwhelming. You underperformed very significantly vis-a-vis, say, just a simple S&P 500 or VTI total market index fund. And so when I see this, it just piqued my interest, right? What is going on here? Why has there been this? First of all, I wanted to document this underperformance, because what people usually do is, and this is extremely, extremely disingenuous, is that they start all of their charts in 1926, and then they do a cumulative return chart all the way to 2025. And then what you see is that the small cap value chart, it just takes off nicely, right? And then in about 2006, it's very high above the S&P. And then you don't even see the last 20 years of underperformance. It looks almost like parallel. And by the way, parallel is not enough, right? Because if they were just parallel, you would have zero outperformance, which means there's really nothing there anymore. But it was even worse than that. It was actually slightly less than that. It was actually negative returns of something like maybe 1%, 1.5%, 2% underperformance over the last 20 years. Then on top of that, you might have to knock off maybe a little bit of extra return, because definitely over the entire 100-year period, right? If you had put together a portfolio that's just a large cap blue chip stock index, much easier to put together, much easier, much faster to trade, much cheaper to trade than the entire small cap stocks are very illiquid. Mm-hmm. And then also separating small cap into growth and value might have taken some time to put this together and to find which stocks do I have to trade into and out of every month. So some of the simulated returns, obviously, they are not as good as you could have achieved if you had actually traded this in past decades. So anyways, I'm not saying that the underperformance of small cap value has to continue forever. It might pick up again, but I'm just telling people, don't get your hopes too high. This right. might just be fluke. This could be, it was some kind of an alpha. What we call alpha in finance lingo is some kind of a special sauce, skill, flavor, market timing or stock picking skill that was in effect for a long time, but then people found out about it and now it's gone away. So, that would be my preferred explanation for why this is no longer working.
Perfect. So. And I'll summarize to make sure I understand. So small cap value, if you look back from roughly 1926 until 2006 or so, slightly higher return than if you just, went with a total stock market.
Slightly is an understatement. It's actually quite substantially higher, right? Exactly. 4% above, right? So you make 7%, but you make 11% with something. Okay. Else. Imagine over 80 years. There's some spectacular.
Huge. 4% higher, but it was higher. Actually like, what is that? Like 80 some odd percent.
Yeah. Yeah,
or 60%.
It's fantastic, fantastic. Okay. It's compounds into something pretty spectacular. So
crazy.
If you had known about this in 1926, you would have been a very rich man today. So
super old as well, but then
but super old too, unfortunately.
Okay, yeah. So there's that portion of it, and eventually people learned about it, and then to your point, the market prices it out. So it's a higher return, so more people put money into it, so the price goes up. There's no free ride, so the risk is built into the price, or the returns are built into the price.
Right.
So
for full disclosure, I'm not the only person saying this. Even if you look at the biggest cheerleader of small cap value, which could be Paul Merriman, right? You might have heard about him, and I've been with him on panels. And so, he does not project forward this 4% plus outperformance, right? He say, even if it's just a half a percentage point or 1 percentage point or between 1 and 2, that would still be really good. And I agree with him. It would still be very good, but I wouldn't bet on it. I wouldn't put any significant amount of money into that bet, because this small cap value also tends to be more volatile. It used to have more pronounced drawdowns and then also very good recoveries out of the drawdown. So it's not, so because some people say, even if the average return is not so good anymore, it's a diversifier. So putting in more small cap value is going to lower your volatility. And that too is wrong, because if you take two assets and they are highly correlated, so small cap value and overall stock market are also very highly correlated, and you take one index that's, say, the S&P 500 maybe had a 16% volatility, and then small cap value maybe had something like 22 to 24% volatility, but they're highly correlated. Well, you're mixing in something that has higher volatility with a high correlation may not help very much with the diversification, may actually increase your portfolio volatility. So that's another point I made in my blog post. So I called it, so last year in December, I wrote that blog post, is our small cap value is a diversification or diversification, right? With the word worse, W-O-R-S-E in the middle. And I showed some numerical examples. And actually, because this is just simple statistics, you mix together something with two different standard deviations, you can get a lower volatility by mixing in a high volatility asset. But that only works if the correlation is low enough. If the correlation is too high, you mix in something with a higher volatility, boom, the mixed portfolio also has a higher volatility. So there's actually some very cute mathematically derived cutoffs that you can derive for for how much correlation can you have. And unfortunately, the small cap value is too correlated to lower volatility at the margin. So even from the volatility side, I didn't really quite see the point of mixing in much small cap value. But it's definitely an intriguing style. And there's a lot, and whenever I write something about this topic, I mean the Twitter discussions, they can go sideways really quickly, because there are definitely some true believers. So there are basically two camps of financial advisors, and some financial advisors, they say, no, we're just going to do the broad index. But there are definitely some financial advisors that are really true believers in this. And I think for them, it's mostly, that's their shtick, right? That they say, well, you could do the index, you could do this yourself. But if you want to do small cap value, if you want to harness these extra returns and diversification, you have to hire me, because
right.
I mean, you look at all the different small cap ETFs and mutual funds. There's just so many now. It's a huge proliferation. I mean, somebody once pointed out, we now have more ETFs than actual underlying stocks. People are churning out these new flavors, new hype ETFs. And it's basically, you get some talking, get some publicity in the news. It's something that the financial industry is, and I used to work in the financial industry, so I can tell you that they always try to come up with some new flavor, some new sexy, excuse my language, style that people find attractive. There are a lot of financial advisors, and that is their thing. And that's also, this is how they justify their fees, which is terrible right now, right? Because small cap value underperformed, and then you have to hire an advisor and pay the advisor something like 1% AUM fee, and then have another 1% negative alpha on that. So this is why if I write something bad about small cap value, I mean, there's some people that their heads are going to explode when they try to argue with some of these people.
And it's so tough, not that our advisor is not in that camp, by the way, luckily.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty straight ahead shooter. It's just like an intermediary, so my wife and I can communicate about our finances.
Hourly only advice, probably, right? So he's no AUM fee.
Correct. No AUM, and it's like we do like an annual engagement currently, to get us on board and blah blah blah. But the overall thought that I have, so one, we'll link up again so people can check out the article that you wrote. Basically, it's so tough because people are great salespeople, right? So they will talk about small cap, and I'm like, oh, I need to do this. They're like, okay, you get a higher return for the same amount of risk. And the thing is, there's no fucking free ride, right? Like either right. the risk is higher or the return, like it's kind of built in. Right. You could fuck it up a little, like if you,
right.
you can mess it up.
I should also point out I'm not saying that you should completely avoid small cap value, and you don't want to sell your VTI and replace it with only tech stocks and only large cap growth stocks. I'm not saying that either, because I'm saying that basically the market is efficient. If you buy small cap value stocks, probably, I mean, my expected return for small cap value stocks, well, it's the same as large cap growth stocks. And maybe you can, even if you assign a little bit of an extra return. And this is what I did in my most recent blog post, which is part 62 of the safe withdrawal rate series. I said, well, what if I recast all of the small cap value returns and make them such that they are on average zero above the S&P 500, right? So I take away all of this early alpha because, well, people in the know, they harvested this alpha and it's good for them, but you cannot repeat this because now everybody knows this secret. So the secret sauce is not so secret anymore. I set this alpha to zero, but then I assign maybe a 2% extra return, or maybe somewhere between 1.5% and 2% extra return from small cap value. Would that have done much better in safe withdrawal rate simulations? And I mean, in some places it did, in some places it did not, because you also add more volatility, and more volatility means steeper drawdowns, means more a sequence of return risk. So from a retirement planning point of view, because then there are some other actors that say, oh, if you add a small cap value to your retirement portfolio, now you can go from a 4% rule to a 5% rule or 5.5% rule, which again, it relies on these old returns with all of this ill-gotten extra return that will likely not repeat going forward. So they're making a correct statement. If you had retired at some of these past retirement dates, you could have raised your retirement safe withdrawal rate. But the question is, how applicable is this really, right?
Right.
And it's exactly what you say, right? Because there are these different equity styles. It's very hard to justify that one style makes much more return than another style. Because if there were, I mean, there are hedge funds, there are stock pickers, there are high frequency trading companies that can pick this up basically within a millisecond, right? So somebody finds out this stock is now a growth stock, no longer a value stock, and then everybody, or somebody figures out now it's a value stock, no longer a growth stock. Now the money rushes in because this is now the new hot commodity. Well, somebody else would have already found this out before you, right? I mean, there's a hedge fund, there's statistical arbitrage hedge funds, there's high frequency traders that will likely outdo you and me and even some other ETF providers that are in that space. So it's very hard that you can make any money. I mean, obviously, for example, stocks have higher returns than bonds on average. Now, that is a premium that I can believe will persist, right? Because stocks have a risk premium over the business cycle, over bonds, or bonds have a risk premium over short-term, say, 3-month T-bills, again, because there's interest rate risk. So there are certain premia that exist that will probably not be so easy to arbitrage away, but I cannot really see how there can be a premium of one part of the stock market over another, and a reliable premium. How can this not be arbitraged away?
Right.
Really quickly. So...
And what I like about the article, you present the, you know, the information that we've talked about here, but you also don't say like, hey, these people are wrong. It's just like, you don't know what's going to happen, but you introduced the uncertainty into my brain because other people make it sound like it's a slam dunk. And then you present data, which I think it gives more of a full picture. So people should have a look at it. Before we jet, a couple more questions. So... Number one, what's coming up on the blog? Do you have any fun topics next 6 months or something?
Funny thing is I have slowed down my writing on the blog, and it still works for me, right? Because a lot of my content is evergreen. But I'll be out over the summer. Not sure if I can really write a lot during that time. I definitely like to write about value versus valuation. So that might be part 63 in the safe withdrawal rate series. So value versus valuation, because people say, well, so you don't believe in value, but you talk about stock valuations a lot. So for example, my punchline is always, if you retire, your safe withdrawal rate is highly correlated to equity valuations, right? If you have very high equity valuations, stocks are very expensive, the CAPE is really high, that correlates very badly with sequence of returns, right? Because that means it doesn't mean it for sure, but there's a higher probability that there's a stock market crash around the corner. So that kind of valuation I actually appreciate, and that should go into the analysis. Whereas value stocks versus growth stocks, I think that is probably something that we can ignore. So, because as some people ask me, well, aren't you inconsistent there? And I want to write a blog post where I write, no, it's not inconsistent. So here is why valuation is something that we should consider, whereas value versus growth, well, that's kind of a crapshoot. I'm not going to bet any money on that. I'll be writing that maybe before the summer, maybe during the summer, maybe after the summer. And then I'll be at the Portland FinCon in September, because that's in my backyard. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you there. And then, you know, final question, I think I know the answer to this, but do you miss working at all? Do you miss the corporate environment?
No, I mean, I'm happy that I'm retired, especially considering what I was able to do. But I always tell people that, you know, looking back at the people that at my old office, right, they all did extremely well for themselves. So the people that stuck it out, and because we right at the time when I retired, we also had some little bit of a corporate restructuring, and a bunch of them left, went to other also very extremely highly regarded companies like BlackRock and State Street. So where I worked in San Francisco, there were three big asset management offices. So BNY Mellon is where I was, State Street and BlackRock. We were all within a few blocks. There was a lot of, mm-hmm. It was a very, very nice community. And yeah, I mean, it's obviously, I mean, you miss that you worked with a bunch of really smart and motivated people. But yeah, I mean, obviously you don't appreciate the stress and the hours and, you know, the performance reviews and the sexual harassment training or anti-sexual harassment training. And then in finance, you have certain other stuff you have to do. So how to detect money laundering and things like that. So all of these financial regulations that you have to mess with. So I'm very happy that I retired, but I think I would have been okay if I had stayed too. So,
yeah, very good. Well, thanks a lot, Karsten. Where should people find you?
Yeah, I blog at earlyretirementnow.com, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. I don't really interact much on Facebook, but I do a little bit of back and forth on Twitter. You can find my Twitter handle on my blog, earlyretirementnow.com.
Very good. Yeah, we'll link up to that. And yeah, looking forward to seeing you in the fall. Thank you.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Okay, so it may come up in the overall interview, but I have some friends that have traveled over to Germany and Europe in general. But Germany, they mention white asparagus is prevalent in many varieties of asparagus. Yeah. So can you tell me about that a little bit? I haven't been to Germany myself.
Yeah, so I'm from Germany, and before I came to the US, I don't think I've ever seen the green asparagus. So the white asparagus is the more common variety. And actually the green one is a little bit poo-pooed on. And so the white one, it comes from Germany. It's extremely elaborate to make it. It's very expensive. It's a delicacy. And it's very seasonal. You only get it for a few weeks during the year. And then after that, maybe you can get some frozen stuff, which is not quite as tasty. And I mean, it's so delicate, and it's such a delicacy. I mean, you would sometimes even eat it without any meat dish. So the asparagus is really the main thing. as the dish, and you just have some potatoes, do some light sauce like a béarnaise or hollandaise sauce, and the asparagus, and that is your meal, and that's a delicacy. And then people would have this at home; they would have it in restaurants. I remember having that as a kid, and it was a great. This is what you would eat on Sundays, basically. So it was a big thing. Yeah.
Another parallel that we have. So I'm half Filipino. And I think about food all the time. I think if someone watched the activities that I do, it's all about food and it's big in the Filipino culture. Your wife is Filipino. Actually, I was reading the about page. She's a nurse too. My mom was a nurse. That's how she came to the U.S.
Yeah. Same with my wife. I mean, so my wife also had multiple routes to come to the U.S., right? Because her parents already lived in the U.S. for a few years and then she followed. But I think she could have also chosen the route as a nurse, right? As a registered nurse, I think you have some pretty good job opportunities here. And then she married me. And I think in the end, it turned out that the fastest way was to just get the green card through me, which also worked. But I mean, The nice thing is we never had to go through this fiancé visa, right? Because she already had access to the U.S. because most of her close relatives already live in the U.S., mostly in the East and Southeast.
Got it. Okay. Well, that said, bringing it back to food. So are you a fan of the Filipino food?
Everything chicken adobo, pork adobo. And then my wife is a huge fan of pretty much any food style, including German food. So she can cook my German cuisine, you know, the red cabbage and the heavy gravy meat stuff with potatoes and the spätzle from the Southwest, which is this is a German variety of pasta. Soft pasta. And yeah, so she likes that. And she cooks really every style. I mean, Filipino, obviously, I like a lot. She can also do any kind of a sushi style, sushi bowl, sushi rolls. That's some of our food that's for special occasions. We would have something like a sushi dinner at home.
Very nice. Yeah. And you're like near the coast. So like you can get some of the freshest stuff, right?
We are in Washington State, and so we have pretty good access to seafood, and then also all the Asian variety food stores here in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon. So we have pretty sweet life here. You
know? Yeah. And I was going to say, you know, we're in Colorado, which the mountains are great. We're far from ocean, so I usually there's actually not a lot of Asian diversity around here.
Oh, wow. So
there's not as many specialty markets and other stuff. There's some small ones, but it's not like back in the Atlanta area where there's so much stuff.
Yeah.